Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. The Northeast Kingdom has a rich history. I dare say the most intriguing stories of Vermont's past come from the NEK. Late Howard Frank Mosier was wonderful at spinning that history into his novels. But for the nonfiction version, there's one writer who's starting to create a wonderful library of these real-life tales of what has happened in the kingdom. Scott Wheeler is the publisher of Vermont's Northland Journal. He's also the author of 7 books on the history of the kingdom and is host of the Vermont Voice on WJJZ-FM in Derby. His most recent book is Newport, Voices for an Evolving Community. And he's with us this hour to share some of the many tales he's written about. Scott, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you for the invite. Well, I should say re-invite because I was on a few months ago.
That's right. We talked about the Northland Journal on that trip, but today we're going to talk about your books. Listeners, if you want to ask Scott about a particular event or person in kingdom history or about one of his books, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Scott, I know you were born and raised in Newport. You live in Derby. But what spurred your interest in the history of the Northeast Kingdom?
Well, that's actually pretty simple. I grew up in a house where my father could go to the dump on Saturdays, and we could come home with more junk than we went with, because my father, well, I used to say he was a junk collector, but he would always, he'd go to the Nettles landfill and we'd dump off our trash, and he'd look around and, whoops, there's a few pieces, and he was always able to spin a dollar off of some of the junk he found. And when I say junk, it really wasn't junk. It was junk to my eyes, but he got a lot of nice antique pieces out of the land, out of the dump. So wow. I kind of grew up in the history world, and that was the beginning.
Well, was there one story?
That was the beginning.
Yeah. Well, Scott, was there one story or subject that really sent you down the path of wanting to share the history of the NEK?
Well, I ended up stumbling onto a job at the Chronicle in Barton, and that's a whole story in its own. And during my free time, I would write history pieces. But the one that really I wanted to do a little bit on was the history of Prohibition in the Northeast Kingdom. And the reason that was interesting to me was because my grandfather had done some activities during the time that apparently were, you know, the lawmen took a dim view to, and he ended up spending some time on vacation at the Windsor Prison. And it wasn't until even just recently, following the publishing of my second Prohibition book, that I actually found out what he'd done. And it was relatively low scale, but at least if he was going to break the law, at least there was a little bit of humor in it. He actually made his own liquor, and he bottled it in baby bottles with nipples and all. And so, he was small scale, and it's hard to believe he got several months in prison, because I couldn't really get the scope of it, because my father wasn't born yet. He's the last surviving child, and he's 86. But so anything he learned about his, he'd heard the stories, but nothing in detail. So, yeah, he was the baby bottle bandit, apparently.
Oh, I love it.
But, yeah, so one thing led to another. I did a series back 20, 25 years ago on Prohibition in the Kingdom, earned myself an Excellence in History Writing Award from the New England Press Association. Then I did my first book, which was Rum Runners and Revenuers, Prohibition in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And, it's been going ever since. And when I left the Chronicle, I began the Northland Journal 19 years ago.
Wow, congratulations. I will tell you, there are rumors that my grandmother from Slovakia, when she came over to America, had a still up on the mountain there and was doing her own moonshining. So now let's get to one of your books, and it's from your new book on Newport. I'd like you to tell us the story of the dancing farmer, Donald Farrar.
Well, the dancing farmer, Donald Farrar, he was, you know, when I spotlight people, I don't spotlight people often who have big names. And a lot of people who think they're important aren't nearly as important as they think they are. They're self-aggrandizing.
Right.
Donald was an old, what you might call a hermit. He never married. He lived on a farm. He actually farmed in Newport Center. And his love in life was farming and dancing. And he just lived. I recorded his story, and he just, it was day-to-day stuff. It was, whether it be the Great Depression, whether it be the solar eclipse, I can't recall which year.
1932, you know, I believe.
Right, okay, and then for his birthday, not too many years ago, He actually took a trip outside of Vermont, one of the only a handful following because he was a diehard Red Sox fan, some friends brought him to Fenway because he was born the last year. He was born in the last year that, well, 1918, I believe that was last year, Red Sox had won a World Series.
Right, up till 04.
And he stayed alive long enough. He wanted to see the Red Sox win. It took him many, many decades, but he did it. So they brought him to Fenway, and they treated him like royalty, got his picture put up on the screen. He was a VIP. And this was just a simple farmer from Newport who just watched history unfold in front of him, and some of it wasn't pretty. He recalled the cross burnings of the KKK. He talked about, you know, other things we don't often think about, but, you know, outhouses. He went into great details about the different kinds of outhouses and, you know, things that, you know, you don't often see written about, but I'm willing to write about outhouses.
Hey, well, how did he get the moniker of being the dancing farmer?
He loved dance halls. He loved dancing in his house, the kitchen junkets. They'd move everything aside, and they have fiddles, and they had piano and everything. They just move. You know, he said dance halls were really great, but he said the kitchen junkets or the kitchen tunks. Mm. He said that's where the action is at. And oh, by the way, he at 100 years old, he said he hadn't married yet, but he said he hadn't given up looking.
Attaboy.
So at 100, he said he was still looking, but well, he passed on before he walked down the aisle.
Oh wow! And they had a big celebration for him in Newport in 2018.
Oh yeah,
as he turned 100.
Yeah, because in 2018, Newport celebrated its first 100 years as an official city, the same year that Donald was born, and he was kind of like an official guest of honor in the parade, and he loved every minute of it.
Oh, I love it. We've got Fred from Newbury joining us. Fred, good morning.
Morning. Hey, I got a good one for you.
All right.
We would have a national referendum, a binding referendum, on whether we should reinstate the draft or reinstate prohibition. Which one do you guys think would win?
Woo. All right, Fred, that's an interesting question. And Scott, since you've written the book about what was going on up there in the NEK during Prohibition.
Well, I didn't really hear the question.
Fred is asking if there was a national referendum and you had to choose between reinstating the draft or reinstating Prohibition, which would the country choose?
Would they choose? Well, in a sense, we I guess we do. We still have to sign up for the draft.
Right.
Boy, that's a hard one. People, boy, I would have to say, I hate to say it, but I think they'd rather reinstitute the draft over instead of their elbow.
Right.
Fred,
right.
He's right. Of course.
And, I don't know if that's a good thing, but good thing or bad thing, but I have to believe people would rather risk their lives than, some people,
right,
than to risk going without their alcohol.
All right. Well, Fred,
as I said, that's neither a good thing or bad thing, but it is right. What it is, I think.
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that, but Fred says you got the answer right, so well done, Scott. Hey, let's discuss another Kingdom character, Walt Spalding, who was a fishing legend. What made him such a great fisherman, Scott?
Well, he was crazy. he loved people thinking he was crazy, kind of. He was a World War II combat veteran, and he loved turning people's eyes. He loved fishing, and he would go out on a skim of ice that no, as he said, even in the article, that no sane human being would do.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring a, when it was really thin, he'd go out with a 4x8 sheet of plywood to keep himself from falling through, hopefully. And he talked about one time, and I think it was more than once, police just stood on shore telling him, "Get in here, you fool. You're going to drown yourself." And he said, "Come out and get me." And he said, "I never had any of the officers. They wouldn't come in and they wouldn't come out and get him." And he survived. He survived into, probably almost 90, and he didn't die from falling through the ice. He did say, in hindsight, he probably took too many risks, but he just absolutely, he worked for Pike's Paving in the summer, and he said, "I didn't have much time to fish in the summer," so he focused mostly on ice fishing, and he went out early because he wanted to fish, but he also, I think he went out early to attract some attention.
Mm. And what made him such a great ice fisherman? He had, you write about his ice fishing prowess.
He had time on his hands. He was laid off all winter long, and he and his friends, for example, the Carter family, who were house painters, they had off a lot of time in the winter, and they still do, and they would get hundreds and hundreds of fish, because they were poor folk, and they used them all, but instead of looking at skinning fish as a chore, which I do, they would actually have fish skinning contests amongst each other, how fast you could skin the perch.
And Walt was darn good at it, so kind of enjoyed it. Very interesting story about Walt Spalding, a great fisherman from the Kingdom. But while we're on the topic of fish, Scott, from your book, When Salmon Was King, what were the fur-bearing trout of Lake Memphremagog?
Well, the fur-bearing trout, it was a mythical species of fish. We also have a mythical monster in the lake up here, too, that if you have enough beer, you too can see that monster. But the fur-bearing trout wasn't actually made. The myth wasn't actually created by Harry and Alice Richardson, who were two very well-known photographers, but it was popularized by them. They took a perch, wrapped it in fur, taxidermied it, and took a photo of it. And that is probably one postcard that is found in probably every country around the world. It showed Harry standing there on the lake with Owl's Head in Quebec on Lake Memphremagog looming in the background with the fur bear and trout. Supposed to be that it's so cold up here that even the fish grow fur. And it's amazing. There are people that I run into typically not from around here, who actually thinks that's a real fish. They don't understand it was just kind of a spoof.
Mm-hmm. And so your version of Champ, is it Memfrey who's up there?
Yeah, I mean, we're not even supposed to utter its name.
Oh, okay.
We have apparently a dinosaur lurking in the lake. As you know, I've sat on the east side deck and had myself some drinks, and I haven't yet had enough to be able to spot it.
Well, good luck with that. Did the fur-bearing trout become souvenirs like the famed jackalopes out west, or was it
the postcards did?
Yeah,
is the postcards are still sought after today. They're just, you know, kind of uniquely dorky.
I love it. All right. Before we go to the break, do you have a favorite story from one of your books or from the Newport book that you'd like to share?
Oh, you know, that's really hard to say because I absolutely love everybody I interview.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see here. I guess I kind of like the one on Gertrude Essoff. She's 98 years old, and that's an amazing success story. Her mother was born at the reservation in Odnak, Quebec, and she ended up, fast forward, Gertrude ended up marrying a first-generation Lebanese man, immigrant, and they were so poor when they were growing up, they couldn't afford anything, and they ended up founding the East Side Restaurant with Gertrude's mother-in-law, a Lebanese woman, and the East Side Restaurant, they owned that for decades, and the East Side Restaurant, although not owned by them anymore, is still going strong, and that was that restaurant came out of the Depression, and they always vowed to give people a good meal, plenty of food, because they knew what it was like to go hungry. So a true American success story.
What should I order when I go to the East Side Restaurant up there in Newport?
Anything fine. I don't eat fish, so go ahead, eat some fish.
Just not the fur-bearing trout.
No, don't do that.
All right, we'll stay off of that. And all right. So I'm speaking with Scott Wheeler, who is the publisher of the Vermont's Northland Journal. He's also the author of 7 books about the NEK. His latest is called Newport, Voices from an Evolving Community. We're hearing about stories from that and about some from the other books that he's written. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll get back to the many tales that Scott Wheeler has written about in his books. Listeners, you can hop in the queue. You can share a story or ask Scott about one of the stories he's written about. Our numbers are 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. And the Sox back in action tonight. They welcome in the struggling Minnesota Twins to Fenway for a 3-game series. Our coverage tonight begins at 6:10. First pitch, 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back with Vermont's Northland Journal publisher, Scott Wheeler. Scott is the author of 7 books on the Northeast Kingdom. His latest is called Newport, Voices from an Evolving Community. And Scott is sharing some of the stories from his books. If you want to ask Scott about A particular kingdom tale you've heard handed down, you can call us at 244-1777, toll free 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Scott, let's see. I want to talk about another animal that's pretty interesting there. There's a chapter in the new book called Main Street's Polar Bear Rescued. That certainly had me intrigued. First of all, where was the polar bear?
The polar bear for many years was located in the window of Frank's Steakhouse. And that was owned by Frank LaChance, and he was a big game hunter. And you could go in, you could go in there, and there were various mounts. If it probably wasn't the ideal place for anti-hunter to go into, but he had a big polar bear that he shot in the 1960s in Alaska. And when Frank's went out of business, all the mounts went into they just put into storage, and then not too many years ago, I believe it decade ago, decade or so ago, they went into went up for auction, and Richard Nelson ended up being the highest bidder, something like $9,000. Of course, he said that was really easy to keep bidding on it because he was using his father's money. Doug Nelson, this area's mega farmer, dairy farmer, he had his eye on it. It is now in his restaurant, the Cow Palace, up in Derby.
Mm-hmm.
And you go in there, and as with Frank's, there's all kinds of mounts, and you know, but the centerpiece is the polar bear that is provided something to stare at for now generations up here. And oh, by the way, if you go up there, you can he has a field full of live elk,
mm-hmm,
and buffalo roaming out in the field. So the Nelsons. Nelson saved the polar bear for future generations.
I love it. Great NEK story. I was also moved by the story of the church that got moved to the top of the world. What was the church? Where had it been?
That was the Christian Science Church that was on Newport's East Main Street, which, interestingly, until 1918, that was the community of West Derby's Main Street. Because East Main, that was West Derby at the time. That church was built well over 100 years ago. And once the church got down to like two or three members, they said, well, this is time. And Todd and Hillary Wright, they have back a few years ago, they relocated a dairy barn to the Quarry Road in Derby to a wedding venue site. Now it's now a wedding venue. It's called Barn at Top of the World, and it's for a reason. There's probably, if it provides unparalleled views of Lake Memphremagog. So now we have chapel at top of the world. So it's a wonderful place to get married. I've been married for 36 years. So I'm not going to go do that. I've had a wonderful marriage, so I'm not going to have to worry about my wedding. So if any listeners who are looking for the ideal place to get married, that is one spectacular place.
All right.
I should note, if you want to see the venue up close this Saturday, beginning at 3, there is Brewfest up there. It's an event to help raise money for mostly Orleans County or Northeast Kingdom residents who are battling serious illnesses.
Hmm.
And that's Brewfest.
All right.
You get to see the venue firsthand.
Excellent. Great. That is Barn at the Top of the World. And now, what is it? Church at the Top of the World?
Chapel.
Chapel at the top. Yeah. All right, Scott, I want to jump back to a book that you wrote called Jay Peak, Voices from the Mountain. When and how did Jay Peak get started?
Well, Jay Peak got started in the 1950s by a group of good local entrepreneurs. They weren't looking to build a resort. They were looking to build a ski area bigger than the many we had here. We had many slopes with rope toes and such. But then they hired a fella, Walter Folger. Walter Folger, only a few years before, we would have viewed as our enemy. He was a World War II German ski trooper, but he was also a ski expert. And for 13 years, he and this group of people and new people coming on helped transform that into a single sloped ski area into a much larger operation. Not what we have today, but it did reach the peak with the tram during his tenure. Without Walter, I'm not quite certain where Jay Peak would be today, because he was a real catalyst behind it.
Well, Jay Peak, somewhat topical again today after the EB-5 scandal, the sentencing of Bill Stenger. Can you tell us about the growth that the resort did undergo during the Bill Stenger era?
Well, I've known Bill for many years. Jay Peak has been a good, they've been a good employer for people. Bill came here in the 1980s, and I know a lot has been written, about what has happened, what happened, and I'm not going to defend Bill, but I'm going to say he came here, and he became an instrumental part of the community. He was on boards. He had a vision. He had a vision for the area. He was on the hospital board. He was on just trying to move this area forward, and he he really endeared himself to many of the people of the area. During the EB-5 days, not too many years ago, he partnered with Ari Quiros. Ari Quiros was a man of apparent means, and he ended up with a mixture of his funds and EB-5 funds, he ended up buying Jay Peak and ended up buying Burke Mountain. And the stars seemed, a lot of people in the area really thought the stars really aligned with this alliance.
Right.
And people started to this is a poor area. Historically it is. And people started looking towards the heavens and started waiting for the money to come. And it came. But sometimes things come too good. Mm-hmm. After a whole city block was torn down on Main Street, which there's some debate whether they could have been salvaged anyway. Then suddenly the feds moved in. One thing led to another, and Bill just had his day in court, and Area's already, now it's in the judge's hands what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, a sad end to what could have been, and that's unfortunate.
But I will I will say this, though. The EB-5 debacle, it's too bad. I hope the people get their money back. But following this, the people of Newport, I don't mean necessarily leadership. I mean the people, it really snapped them to. They stopped looking skyward, and they started looking inwards, and they started doing things that we're so proud of, you know, we're resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Since that, Newport has begun to flourish. We now have a tour boat, Northern Star back on the lake. Newport is beautiful. Newport is really, I think Newport has turned the corner.
That's a good optimistic view. First of all, tell us about the Northern Star.
Well, the Northern Star, it arrived on the lake a few years ago, but you know, between a poor economy, COVID, and you know, a business plan that apparently didn't work too well, it was mothballed for a few years. And then along comes Rick. Well, I shouldn't say it. It's not only Rick, because a group of people bought it and made it into a nonprofit. And they hired Rick, who's a farm boy, who has a vision and has a strong work ethic. And no, it's not only him, but I dare say Rick is making it happen. They now have theme tours, history tours. It's a real happening boat. I dare say it's probably the most successful boat we've. Yeah, it is. It's certainly the most successful tour boat we've had on the south side of the lake for decades. Certainly have to, if you want to go on it, you have to go online and get a reservation, because especially weekends they really fill up. They have music, entertainment, and you know, you can take leisurely tours too, and you can also rent it. I think groups, people can hold reunions, birthdays, you know, I'm not sure how many people you need, maybe 25,
mm-hmm.
but great, great little boat.
All right. That's great to hear. And I know Rick has really poured his heart and soul into that project. So it's great to hear that it is afloat and doing well.
You need to get him on the show, because he'll reveal you. Oh,
yeah. I had him on earlier this year and he was phenomenal. So. Yeah, it was great to talk to him. Hey, Scott, one of my favorite stories from the NEK is Gerald Bull and his factory. This is found in your book on Jay. Who was this guy, and what was his plan up there?
Woo! can we extend this show for a day long? Well, to make a really long story, fascinating story, really short, is Dr. Bull was a Canadian. He was a ballistics scientist, I believe. His mission was not to create weapons of war. He wanted to build big guns that would shoot payloads into space, not rocketry. And then fast forward, he comes to the United States, becomes a citizen at the encouragement of the United States government, and he becomes begins manufacturing munitions on both sides of the border, big guns, and just the payloads and such. And so fast forward, he's employing many people at very good pay, 1960s into 1970s. Next thing you know, he is... he's arrested. He and Colonel Gregory are arrested and for shipping arms to South Africa using Dr. Bull's other operation in Brussels, Belgium, to ship them through to shipping some of his weaponry to South Africa against the U.S. embargo. And Dr. Bull always knew the CIA was going to come forward and acknowledge to the courts that this was a CIA operation. Because guess what happened? CIA didn't come through for him, and he went to jail not for that long, he and Colonel Gregory. And he was so distraught afterwards, he moved all of his operations to Belgium, and he became a freelance arms dealer working for various people, including to the lead up to the Persian Gulf War. He was working for Saddam Hussein, and he was building this giant gun against a mountain, and it was the direction of that gun that drew the attention of the Israelis. It was pointed towards Tel Aviv, and they gave him warning that that if you don't stop doing that, we're going to have to do something about that. And he didn't, and he was assassinated in Belgium. There was debate for many years whether he was taken out by the Israelis or by the CIA, and I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that it was the Mossad, and actually they've laid claim to it now. And that was all in Jay Highwater. He also developed some of the early Star Wars systems, as in the early Star Wars trying to shoot down intercontinental missiles. But yeah, you think of Jay Vermont, and you don't think of international intrigue and an Israeli assassination.
Scott, we got some late calls. Let's see what we can do. We'll talk to Stephen first from Montpelier. Stephen, go right ahead. Keep it brief.
Okay, just wanted to mention John Garda in Colebrook, who came over to Bloomfield, hid under the railroad track, and went down to he killed a bunch of people in Bloomfield, hid under the railroad track in Bloomfield, and then went down to the Brunswick Springs, where he set up an ambush, and eventually he was killed at Brunswick Springs.
Mm. All right, Stephen, thanks for that. Ray in Hardwick, real quick, what do you got?
We have the Highland Cattle, and this year the Greensboro Historical Society is featuring the Highland Cattle, our farm, at the Greensboro Historical Society in Greensboro. Also, you're talking about fishing.
Mm-hmm.
We have the only proof there was ever walleye pike at Long Pond in North Greensboro, and there's a picture of it at the Historical Society. My dad used to catch cattle with pit bull bulldogs. He caught 468 head of cattle in the state of Vermont.
All right, Ray, we're going to have to leave it there. Scott, I'm going to just go back to you for seconds. These stories, John Garda, the Highland Cattle, the walleyed pike in Long Pond, any of these you covered, or are these new territory for you for future books?
Actually, some of them are new, and that's how come I welcome people to submit their own memories to the Northland Journal at northlandjournal@gmail.com, because reader written material is great. People do their own research, share their own memories, and submit them, and we will edit them up because we can't be everywhere.
Yep.
That's how come we welcome people to submit articles. We're also found on Facebook and on the online.
So, yep. Northlandjournal.com. All right. Scott Wheeler, publisher of Vermont's Northland Journal, author of 7 books on the history of the kingdom, and you can visit northlandjournal.com. Scott, always a pleasure having you on the show, and you've got some new fodder for future stuff, so thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you for the invite.
Absolutely. All right. When you hear what we've got next, maybe we should have talked about Scott's book, Booze in the Kingdom. It's the wine show next hour here on WDEV. And coming up at 1 today, we've got Equal Time with Travin, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with the incomparable Mr. Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Danny, a few glasses, please. It's time for wine. Well, even though it might be a scooch early to actually be trying any wines, it's never too early to discuss them and to get some excellent advice and suggestions on choosing wines. So break out the rosés, the chillable reds, the chablis, and the chardonnays, and maybe even a champagne. It's time for the wine show this hour. Joining us with their wine wisdom is Laura Atkins, chef owner of the Kitchen Table Bistro in Richmond. Laura, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And we've got David Keck. He's a master sommelier and the wine director at the Vermont Wine Shepherd. David, it's great to have you back as well.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, listeners, to ask Laura and David about wines or pairings or to suggest something you've been enjoying lately, you can give us a call at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. The email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Laura, right out of the gate, give us a suggestion for, it can be a specific wine, a variety, a vintner that has you excited right now.
Well, goodness, this time of year, August, it screams rosé.
Mm-hmm.
sparkling rosé or still rosé, that's for sure. I am a huge fan of the Parasol rosé out of Provence. They have several different levels, different price points. Spectacular, a dry rosé that is fun on the patio or as a sipper, or it definitely pairs beautifully with salmon or all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. And David, how about you?
Oh, so many options. I mean, talking about rosé, I think, you know, I couldn't agree more about Provence. I mean, they are the greatest and most famous region for rosé production. But also love a lot of the stuff happening elsewhere in Europe, and drinking a lot of the Umatum rosé, which is from Burgenland. It's right on the Hungarian border in Austria. Pretty outstanding. A little bit richer, a little bit more sort of full-bodied, a lot of fruit to it than sort of what you see out of Provence, but great, again, with food and a lot of the...
Oh, did we lose David? Let's see. David, you still with us? All right, let's try to get David back as we're talking about rosés. And, I don't know... Laura, I am not really sure what a rosé is. I know it's pink. I know it's somewhere between red and white. can I make my own? Can I just take some red and some white and pour them together? What's the deal with
rosé? A cuvée.
Yeah.
A rosé is a wine made with grapes that minimally are stay on the juice, the skins stay on the juice, so that's where the pale pink comes from, and you see so much variation in the color of the pink. It can be darker, it can be very, very pale, it can be salmon-colored. It all depends on the grape varietal and the length of time the juice, the wine, actually has made contact with the grape skins.
All right, okay. And David, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
That's okay. These things happen with cell phones in Vermont. We understand that.
Yeah.
it's an occupational hazard here on our show. And David, why is it, when we get to summer, all of a sudden our minds just in the wine thing, it's just like, oh, rosé. This is my time for rosé. Why is it such a special summer thing?
You know, I think it has something to do with just the timing of rosé releases.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, we can kind of talk about age-worthiness in rosé, too, which I think is a super interesting topic. But, you know, most rosés from, like, if we're talking about the Northern Hemisphere, the 2020 rosés kind of hit in the spring. Usually, you know, we start seeing the stuff from Provence and from elsewhere in Europe and the stuff in the States from the 2020 vintage hits the market right about March, April around here. So that's kind of, you know, it's kind of a celebratory, hey, you know, it's kind of a first sign of spring and summer. And so there's that element to it. But it also, you know, it's a chillable wine that has beautiful character to it and pairs beautifully. You know, it's just kind of, I think, a combination of timing and just, yeah, association over, I think, sort of historical context.
All right. Now, Laura, I know important for you at the Kitchen Table Bistro is making sure that you have wines that will go well with the changes to your menu, to your specials. So how do you accomplish that?
Well, we definitely gear the wine list seasonally, as we also do the obvious cuisine menu. And like David was just saying, like the arrival of rosés in the spring for us, we've survived winter and, you know, that first green thing from the ground. So those just play hand in hand with one another when it comes to pairing. But, you know, we have more whites on the menu during the warmer months, and we have chillable reds on the menu during summer months and during the summer months for the chillable red also. You know, we go lighter, less the deep, rich wines that you typically want to pair with richer foods that you typically want to have in winter, although we sell a lot of braised things here in the summer, which is crazy, but but that's sort of the way we go. We just go lighter, crisper.
Hey, David, now chillable reds, you know, we've been instructed that, you know, we chill the whites, the reds we just, you know, open up and let breathe and then serve. So what's the deal with chillable reds? Can any reds be chilled? Are there specific ones that really work chilled?
For sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm definitely a bit of an aggressive or outspoken person with respect to the temperature of wine, because I think that all reds should actually be chilled down a little bit, especially in the summer. And so, you know, the cooler a red wine gets, the more you get the acidity and sort of some of the other structural elements to it. The warmer it gets, the more you get the alcohol and the fruit. And so if you're serving a wine at just room temperature, you're going to get a more sort of aggressive fruit profile. Where if you're serving it at cellar temperature, say like 55, 60 degrees, I think you get sort of that perfect combination of all the factors, the fruit, the acidity, the brightness and floral characters. And then as it warms up, it'll sort of evolve and change. And so a lighter bodied red wine really benefits from having a bit of a chill on it. So I always say, you know, start at cellar temp, no matter what it is, at 55 degrees. And if it's a super light bodied red wine, say like Pinot Noir from Burgundy or Beaujolais or some of the Loire Valley reds, I think taking them down even cooler to 45 or 50 degrees really accentuates that bright, lifted floral character in a really nice way.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, David, you know, there are so many wines, so many different varieties, so many vintners, and a lot of us finally find, you know, a few that we like, you know, hit our sweet spot. But how do we wean ourselves off our standards, our go-tos, to try new stuff, to, you know, for something more exciting or something challenging?
Well, I think, and I probably said this in the last time we chatted, and I'm sure I've said it 1,000 times, is that I think finding a wine shop where they listen to you and where you can find a purveyor of wines or a restaurant, honestly, and chatting with Laura or chatting with somebody in a place that you really enjoy and saying, hey, this is what I drink normally. These are the things that I like, but I'm excited to try new stuff. What do you recommend? And then go back to the shop after you try their suggestion and tell them how it went. Because I, you know, as a sommelier, I learn so much more from someone when they tell me the things they don't like than when I learn from the things that they do enjoy. Mm-hmm. Right? When somebody comes in and is like, I had this and it was not what I wanted to drink, and we can have a conversation about why, then it helps me so much more in steering them to a new beverage that they might enjoy.
Absolutely. All right. We have a call from Steven, who's joining us from Montpelier. Let's get Steven in here. Go right ahead, Steven.
Hi. I just have a quick story about mm-hmm. my cousin who grows white grapes in a graveyard on the north shore of the Lake of Zurich in Switzerland. And after they make this, it has the Grim Reaper on the label. And after they make the white wine, they take the skins and put them in barrels and make a liqueur called Grappa, mm-hmm. which is very delicious.
All right. Do you know the name of the vineyard there?
I don't know the name of the vineyard, but it's called something. It has the name, the label has the Grim Reaper on it.
All right. Either of you familiar with that particular wine?
No, that sounds remarkable.
It does.
No, not familiar with the wine, but I love Grappa, and I've thought about trying to sort of collaborate with some of the spirits producers here in Vermont to make Grappa. I mean, it's very famous sort of use for the end, the must when you're done making wine. You know, everybody is looking for, I would say, all the ways that you can possibly use and reuse and recycle materials. And after you've made wine, you basically add water and then re-ferment and distill the product. So it's a grape must spirit called Grappa, very famous in Italy as a sort of after-dinner beverage, and some truly spectacular versions of it. So,
Stephen, thanks for that. We'll be on the lookout for Grim Reaper on the label. Laura, is the kitchen table back up to being open, same hours pre-pandemic? Where are you now with what's going on there?
Thanks for asking. No, we are probably never going to go back to what we were before, which was 5 days a week, just for so many reasons, mental health more than anything for all of us. But we decided we're sticking with 4 days open. We are offering indoor and outdoor dining right now, but the limiting factor is staffing, actually having enough staff, both kitchen staff in front of the house. So days sell out simply because we just don't have enough bodies to help us. So, but that's okay. We know our limitations, and the folks we get in here to have an experience have been super positive and appreciative of anything we can offer.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I think people are understanding right now that it is a tough time to find the necessary staffing. So get reservations, you know, plan ahead, and just be patient. That's really what we've kind of learned, right, in this all.
Yes.
And speaking of the pandemic, David, we, the collective we, certainly have been enjoying imbibing during the pandemic. So did the Vermont Wine Shepherd see that, an uptick in wine sales?
Absolutely. And, I mean, as with, I think, all forms of consumption, it all kind of just moved to a retail situation. And so, which has been interesting just because being a sommelier and selecting a lot of our wines, we've chosen a portfolio that really is geared more to restaurant and to on-premise service, but it's forced us to kind of rethink that business model. And also, I think people have been rethinking how they drink during the pandemic and where they're finding their beverages of choice. So,
well, David, is there a certain trend that's taken off in this past year during the pandemic, or one that you think we're on the cusp of? You want to tell us about?
Oh man, it's hard to know. It's funny because I think that they're so regionally specific. I think there are things that are coming, that I'm seeing in Vermont that I've seen in other places sort of earlier. I think there's a big orange wine push right now, which, you know, I think orange wine or the sort of skin contact white wine movement really took off in New York about 10 years ago. And, you know, I saw it when I was in Texas for sure. And I feel like in Vermont, we can't even keep it in stock when we bring in a lot of the skin contact white wines. So I think that's kind of definitely happening around here regionally. I think there are a lot more folks doing things that, you know, is interesting with the caller earlier bringing up Grappa, but I've seen a lot more Piquette in the market as well, which is an ancient, you know, French technique for reusing grape skins where you actually add water and re-ferment and make a very low alcohol beverage. And I think we're seeing a lot of low alcohol choices out there, which is probably smart considering consumption went up during the pandemic. So consuming more, but maybe at a lower alcohol level isn't a bad thing.
And David, you better explain orange wine, because I'm seeing people stopping on citrus to make a wine. I'm pretty sure I'm well wrong about that.
Yeah, so orange wine is essentially just, you know, a white wine made the way that white or the way that red wine is made. So it's using white grapes generally with, but allowing it to ferment on the skins, which is what you do with red wine to actually give it its color. So most grape juice is white. Pinot Noir, Cabernet Sauvignon, they all have white juice for the most part. And so the color comes from macerating that juice with the skins. Mm-hmm. Orange wine is really taking white grapes, pressing them and allowing them to sit on the skins. And then a lot of those, elements within the skins that are extracted into the wine then oxidize and the wine takes on color. And as those oxidize, they turn kind of amberish or orange. And so, it's an ancient, you know, technique, and probably the earliest white wines were orange just because we didn't have the technology to get the wine off of the skins rapidly enough without them extracting some of those phenolic compounds. So it ends up, you end up with a white wine with a little bit more texture, sometimes tannin, and a broad range of totally different flavor profiles.
So. Interesting. Laura, how about from your customers? Are you hearing certain things requested, certain trends you're seeing there at the kitchen table?
Well, again, not to drive it into the ground, but definitely rosé. Rosé mm-hmm. sales this just all of summer have been out of control. Sparkling rosé especially, just unbelievable. We can't keep it in. It's just remarkable. And then, you know, honestly, the lighter bodied reds, Pinot Noir, Gamay, we have another, what's the other one? The Barbera that we have right now is on the lighter side, Tempranillo. Just the lighter bodied wines on both sides of the color spectrum.
All right, Laura, I'm going to give you a chance now to tantalize us with some food. I'd love for you to just tell us about something, an entree that you're serving at the Kitchen Table Bistro there in Richmond that will, you know, really get us going, something to entice us this morning.
Sure, sure. So we're getting some beautiful swordfish out of Maine from Brown Trading Company out of Portland. And we are grilling that and serving it with grits from Anton Mills Company out of North Carolina. They're fresh grits, so they come to us refrigerated, and I'm a Southern girl. So love getting to share a whole different grit experience with people. Always, right now, we're in the middle of the heirloom tomato season, so heirloom tomato relish and an herb drizzle over the whole thing. It's super fresh, very light, and the grits are fun.
Oh, it sounds delicious. And David, you know, when I have Laura serve us something wonderful, I'm going to ask you to pair a wine with it. So what do you serve with that grilled swordfish and grits?
Oof. I mean, so as soon as you grill something, and swordfish is such a meaty fish to begin with, mm-hmm. and has a lot of texture and a lot of beautiful flavor to it, especially when it's fresh like that. But as soon as you grill it, it sort of amps up that flavor profile. So, I mean, we may as well just keep beating this dead horse and say you should probably throw a rosé at it. And, you know, I think, and right now I'm trying to support Oregon as much as I can, and mm-hmm. we've talked a little bit, you know, gone back and forth about sort of the fires out there, and people have been struggling. But a lot of wine went into rosé last year because of the fires and because so much fruit was damaged. And so there's some really spectacular rosé coming out of Oregon right now. And I think, you know, there's some stuff that would go nicely. And so speaking of sparkling rosé, right now we have a limited edition Petnat rosé from two very good friends who make wine out there, Bree and Chad Stock. So Petnat being basically sort of the wine version of a bottle-conditioned beer. It just finishes fermentation in the bottle. They're making it with Cabernet Franc, so it already has kind of a cool, smoky, herbaceous character that I think would go beautifully with that grilled swordfish. And then grits, yeah, it would everything would work well together.
All right. There we go. Rosé is top of the list for everybody this morning, and that's great to hear. sparkling rosé with the swordfish, the grilled swordfish, would be fantastic. And is there another vintner, David, that Vermont Wine Shepherd is carrying right now that you're really excited about?
Well, there's a bunch. We carry Joseph Swan's wines out of California, and I think those wines are always really special. It's a winery that Joe Swan was, originally a pilot, decided to plant Pinot Noir in the Russian River Valley in the 70s, which nobody had really done up to that point. And now we just think of the Russian River Valley as being the home for Pinot Noir in California in many senses. But he was really the groundbreaking person. And his son-in-law now, Rod Berglund, runs the winery with his wife, Lynn, Joe Swan's daughter. And they still just make such spectacular wines. And we were talking about Chillicothe Reds. We just got in their Valdigay, which is a great variety that very few people have heard of, but most people may have consumed at one point or another. It used to be known as Napa Gamay, and it's absolutely delicious and bright and cheerful and with a good chill on it is spectacular.
Mm. Laura, we got about a minute before the break, so throw out another suggestion for us, something else that you're really enjoying right now.
For wine or food?
Let's go with wine now.
Okay, awesome. Well, my favorite white varietal, just changing it away from the rosés, mm-hmm. is Chenin Blanc right now. Oh, my goodness. I just love it, love it, love it. It's a little bit fuller body, but still there's enough acidity to be just lovely paired with food, but also just sipping it on your patio. Love it.
David, why do you like it? You jumped right in there as soon as Laura said Chenin Blanc.
Oh, I love Chenin, absolutely. And we represent a few. We have one from Napa made by Lola, and then we've got Chenin from the Loire Valley by Pierre Menard, and then a spectacular Chenin from South Africa from the Saadi family. It's just one of those great varieties that has such beautiful acidity and richness, but it really represents place in a way that, I guess, similar to Riesling in the sense that wherever you plant it, it takes on the character of that place and is so specific in the way it expresses itself and is just delicious. It can be dry, it can be bubbly, it can be sweet, it's just such a versatile variety.
Oh, excellent. Let's put a cork in it, but just for a few minutes. We've got CBS News, and then we'll be back for more Gab About the Grape with David Keck and Lara Atkins. And coming up today at 11 o'clock on WDEV, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. It's the wine show until 11 with David Keck of the Vermont Wine Shepherd and Laura Atkins of the Kitchen Table Bistro in Richmond to chat with our guests about some of your favorite wines. You can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Laura, I was just thinking as we heard that test of the emergency alert system, if we had to go to a bunker, a fallout shelter, what wine would you take with you? And David, you're up next, so be thinking about it.
Oh, geez. That's a tough one. Let's see. I probably would take a red, so I probably couldn't chill it. So I think it would probably be a Pinot Noir from Oregon.
Yep. All right. I'm with you in that shelter. How about you, David?
It sounds like a good choice. God, I hate that question. I'm sorry. It's like, why? Why do I have to choose?
Well, you know what? You're a guest here. You can step over the question if you don't want to answer it. It's okay.
No, I always want to drink Syrah, so I'd probably try and find a nice bottle of Northern Rhone Syrah or maybe California Syrah. nice, smoky, peppery, and, you know, contemplative enough to give me something to think about in that bunker.
Oh, and you don't have to take just one bottle. You can take cases, right? We're in there for a while,
good.
So
yeah,
don't worry.
We're in there for a minute, yeah.
Right. That's right. Okay. All right. Well, David, you talked about smoky, and let's talk about Oregon. You mentioned it kind of a little bit before the break and the wildfires there. So, you know, what has been the effect? Should we be worried about the vintners out there in the Willamette Valley, you know, and those great Pinots that we've enjoyed?
Yeah. No, I think absolutely. Unfortunately, I was out there for a wine competition to fine taste about 300 Oregon wines from varying vintages. And when they tasted, really, it was the 2017 was the last time they had some fire issues. And then 2020, we had some rosés and some white wines from 2020 that are already starting to show the effects of smoke taint, which is kind of a hard thing to track. They can test for it, but a lot of times by the time the test came back, especially during COVID, everybody was so backed up, and there were fires in California as well.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was sending all of their wine to get sampled and to get tested, and the results often wouldn't come back until after you'd already decided to invest in making the wine, which is a huge problem if you put the money into it. So, and then any of the grape varieties that were hanging longer, so a lot of that Pinot in Oregon that needed to hang a little bit later in the season, a lot of it was just either destroyed or bulked out to, but people weren't making wine. So. Mm.
Laura, have you been seeing any problems getting some of the wines from out west that you normally like to offer?
Definitely. We, several of our staples from Oregon and California, actually, from what we have been told from our purveyors, that these particular ones opted to not make wine, just as David was discussing. It's a huge undertaking, obviously, and if the wine is going to be tainted and unsellable, obviously they don't want to put that investment in. Completely understand, but it's definitely disappointed some customers who definitely order the same bottle every time they come in, and we are definitely going to be a couple of years out of vintages of those brands.
Oh, so, boy. Laura, where did your interest in education in wine start?
Gosh, probably my parents. They always encouraged fine food and wine, not fancy, but we talked about food, and my parents certainly sipped wine at dinner every evening. And after graduating college and going to culinary school, I was really encouraged by the chef that I worked for right before culinary school to dig deep and learn more simply by tasting. Go to exactly like what David was saying. Go to a trusted wine shop. Just pick something off the shelf, start trying wines, you'll learn what you like, you'll learn what you don't like, and then you can study up on those things. It's sort of been a lifelong thing for me, super fun.
Yeah. And David Keck, how does one go from enjoying wine to becoming a master sommelier?
Well, you decide to give up most other things in your life. And yeah, I mean, it's a pretty – those who – decide to go from sort of the beginning of the path, which is sitting the intro level course with the Corps de Master Sommeliers, to becoming a Master Sommelier is about an 8-year process. For those that actually achieve it, and the pass rate on the exam is about 3% at this point. So it's kind of an obsessive compulsive thing. You know, it starts with the enjoyment. And for me, it was always working in the field and cultivating as much knowledge as possible, just tasting as much as I could and studying those things. Where it gets into, you know, once you get past the first couple of levels of exams, then it gets into a lot of the minutiae that require a certain level of obsession when you're reading, you know, French appellation wine law and Italian bottling laws and things like that. You know, I think are good to know, but I often equate it to, you know, most doctors need to go through sort of general medicine before they specialize, and this is kind of, you know, becoming a master sommelier is like learning everything about a little bit about everything, or a lot of bit a about everything. and then you decide, you know, what you want to do with that information.
Well, David, like a surgeon who has to protect his hands, are you that way with your tongue? I mean, do you have someone test the soup first to make sure it's not too hot and we'll burn the taste buds?
No, I don't. I mean, when you're sitting exam, sommeliers are pretty neurotic just because your sense of smell is so crucial to your ability to pass those exams. So everybody kind of has their own rituals and ways to stay healthy and keep your palate fresh. But after you kind of get past that point, you try to go back to being a normal human.
All right. Let's as much as one can. All right. Let's let's talk about some trends. I'll start with you, Laura. Boxed wine. I know this is, you know, certainly light years ahead of what it was back in the day, but are there good boxed wines? Is it something you would recommend to people?
I definitely would never discourage it. I believe that there are really high quality ones again, go to a trusted wine shop. They're really good about getting in ones that might be a little more high quality than one brand that I'm not going to say.
Sure,
But even, you know, even the lower priced boxed wine, it's not terrible wine. There is, I think, highly palatable wine out there in boxes that is a good way to introduce yourself to some varietals. You know, let's put it that way.
David, what are the disadvantages of boxed wine as opposed to the bottled wines that we are used to?
Yeah, so I think I agree with Laura that there's a lot of advantages to them. I think the disadvantages have to do with any sort of age worthiness. You know, if a box, we don't really think about wine having an expiration date so much. I mean, you don't want to drink necessarily a wine intended to be consumed within a year, 3 years in, but most box wine is really built to be consumed within about a year. So if a box has been sitting there for a while and you're looking at older vintages, it just doesn't really keep particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what it's intended for anyway.
Point well taken. And I'm glad you pointed that out. All right. How about, David, low calorie or less sugar wines?
Well, so I can't speak to it. Honestly, there isn't, in most of the wines on the shelf, if you're looking at dry wines, there isn't any sugar anyway. I mean, it's less than 0.1 grams per liter of, or, you know, 0.5 grams per liter, really, to be considered dry. Above about 2 grams per liter or 3 grams per liter is where you have perceptible sweetness. So if people are thinking about keeping sugar intake down, wine doesn't really play in, unless you're drinking sweeter wines. But even like what people would consider a sweet Riesling from Germany or something like that still has less sugar than the, like, you know, 2 sips of Coca-Cola in the entire bottle. So it's all pretty relative. Low calorie, I honestly haven't the faintest idea. It's nothing I've cared too much about. I think wine's an important grocery and we shouldn't be too stressed about it.
All right. So stay with the regular wines is definitely what we're hearing here. All right. Laura, I want you to tell us about a dish that's on your menu. It sounds phenomenal. It's the ricotta gnocchi with summer tomatoes, Konanz Farm, and I think you can pretty much walk into the field over at Konanz where they have fabulous corn, basil, and feta. Tell us about that dish and then what you would pair it with.
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, delish. It is summer in a bowl. That is one of our favorite dishes to bring back each summer this time of year, in the beautiful synergy of Konanz corn, which is literally the best corn on the planet, and the fresh heirloom tomatoes. So the kitchen makes the gnocchi from Maple Brook Farm ricotta. So they drain it, and then they make it into the little pillows that are ricotta. And those get cooked to order, and the chef at the same time is sauteing up a mixture of the corn and tomatoes. And then that goes over the gnocchi with then a drizzle of pretty much a basil-driven herb dribble over the top. So delish. And, gosh, I would probably By the glass, that would be, I would pair our Pinot Grigio that we have from the winery Scarpetta out of Friuli, Italy. It is crisp and wonderful. It's a fuller-bodied white, but there's enough acid that it would really complement the rich gnocchi, I believe.
Oh, my gosh. That sounds like the perfect summer dish and drink right now. That's phenomenal. David, I'm going to dinner. I've been asked to bring some wine. How about a bottle, maybe $15 to $30, that would really be a great bottle of wine to take? Give me a red and a white.
Where are you going? Who are you dining with? What
are you eating? I'm going over to Lara's, but
okay. Well, I mean, it's again. There's so many options, and I think a huge part of it is, there is a different wine for every person and every situation and setting. For a white wine, I think going. You know, something that has a user-friendly aspect, but it's not maybe as well-known. Something like the Vetsoff Chardonnay out of South Africa, I think, is fabulous. It's an un-oaked Chardonnay, but it still is grown in this beautiful limestone soil, has a lot of richness to it. It spends some extended time on those lees in a way that they do in Chablis, so just sort of stirring up that yeast. As it's after it's done fermenting, gives it a lot of texture and richness, and it's right in between $15 and $20 retail. It's a great, great bottle of wine. So I think that would be, user friendly and a great wine for people who are like, oh, I don't like Chardonnay. It's like, well, maybe you should try this and see if that's really, really a thing. And a red wine. So many options. I think again, we're in the season to do sort of a lighter bodied wine. Mm-hmm. And we work with this really wonderful organic producer out of Austria named Thomas Straka is the producer, and the wine is just Stratos Red. It's a blend of a number of different varieties. It's very light bodied. It's got a little funkiness to it, but it's under screw cap, so if you're taking it to the park or to the river or something like that, you're in good shape. And it has just a really nice, beautiful kind of spicy character without being overpowering. So pairs with a lot of food, too.
Well, you score a point. Straka was my grandmother's maiden name. So,
oh, my God.
I know. No isn't way. That interesting? Yeah, I'll have to seek that one out. That really has me interested. All right. How about regions that you really love? Laura, I'll start with you. Is there a region you love when you're choosing a wine?
Oh, gosh. Well, yes. Large region. I'm a sucker for a French wine. Minutely, I love Provence and I love Loire. And then red wise would be Burgundy and then Beaujolais within that are my probably favorites personally.
How about you, David?
I'm super excited by what's going on in Spain right now. I think Northwest Spain up in Galicia or sort of green Spain is an awesome region for, again, some lighter bodied red wines, but also some more serious bottles as well. And then gorgeous whites and a lot of really interesting work as far as viticulture. There's a lot of organic and biodynamic production, a lot of really sort of, I would say, a sensibility that's in line with what's happening in, what Vermonters kind of look for as important elements in farming. And then, honestly, I think Portugal is fabulous. We don't represent any wines right now from Portugal, but I think it's another place where we don't currently see a bunch of the cool stuff that's happening, but it's, I think, just beginning to trickle into the market, and we're going to see a lot more in the future. Of some really, really well-made wines.
Northwest Spain sits right on top of Portugal, so you have that nice strip of the Iberian Peninsula that you're kind of focusing in on right now, David. The last time we spoke, we talked a little bit about your own winery, and so I wanted to see if there's an update on how things are going with, is it Stella 14 Wines?
Yeah, Stella 14. It has been a long process as far as permitting, but we are kind of in the home stretch of that, and just now beginning to get label approvals. So I would say stay tuned, but it should be hopefully in the market this fall. And wines from the 2020 vintage that we grew and made from the grapes up here at Boyden Valley.
Exciting. And David, I think every brewer, vintner, spirit maker, and cider maker in the state who's been through that process is, you know, lamenting or has some, you know, empathy what you've gone through, because it's always like, well, we'll be ready in March and, you know, September.
And then, yeah.
I know.
But I think I can safely say that we're in the home stretch at this point. So fingers crossed.
That's great to hear. All right. We're going to finish it up. You'll each get to make another suggestion. Laura, what kind of wine, what wine would you like to suggest to people that they check out?
Let's see. Again, I'm going to stick with some whites, the varietal Melon de Bourgogne, or sometimes just labeled as Melon. Delicious, lemony, briny, light, perfect for this time of year.
Mm, that sounds exciting. Now, where is that from? Where is that being produced?
France.
I'm sorry.
My favorite part of the wine world. Sorry.
I should have known. I apologize.
You can find it in there are some American makers also, but of course my favorites are from France.
I'm pretty sure everyone listening right now, David and Laura, yelled at their radio, France, you idiot. All right. Yeah, I understand. David, how about you?
You know, we just brought in a producer about 6 months ago that I think is doing amazing work called Castel d'Age. They're down in Penedès, back on the Spain bandwagon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they check a lot of important boxes, I think, right now in society as well as in winemaking, being a 100% biodynamic estate. So they're really in tune with the natural world and the way they're growing the grapes, and it's been owned by 3 generations of women. And they make a really beautiful sparkling wine, a cava that is brut nature, which means basically super, super dry. You were asking about sugar content. Mm-hmm. Sparkling wine is one of the usual perpetrators if there is a wine with some sweetness to it, and they are doing a bone dry bubbly that is just perfect for this weather and also just great to support them as a winery.
Mm, that sounds fabulous. David Keck is a master sommelier, and he's the wine director at the Vermont Wine Shepherd. Laura Atkins is chef owner of the Kitchen Table Bistro in Richmond. Thank you both so much for spending this wonderful hour with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, David, for having us.
All right, take care.
Good to hear you.
That was delicious. All right. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan, produced by Rachel Connor and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Listeners, feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. You can subscribe to it there as well. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next, followed today by the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference that'll happen just after the CBS News. And for the rest of the week, we will spend some time each day reflecting on Tropical Storm Irene, starting tomorrow with VT Digger's Kevin O'Connor discussing what we learned from Irene. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.